On the fifth day, they approached Clark and slowed down. It had been an asteroid about 2 kilometers across, a carbonaceous hunk now shaped to a cube, with every centimeter of its Mars-facing surface graded and covered with concrete, steel, or glass. The cable plunged right into the center of this assemblage. There were holes on both sides of the joint where cable met moon, just big enough to allow passage to the elevator cars. They slid up into one of these holes and came to a smooth stop. The interior space they slid into was like a vertical subway station. The passengers got out and went their ways into the tunnels of Clark. One of Phyllis's assistants met him and drove him in a little car through a warren of rock-walled tunnels. They came to Phyllis's offices, which were rooms on the planet side of the moon, walled with mirrors and green bamboo. Though they were almost in microgravity and only drifting very slowly away from Mars, they stood on that floor and rip-ripped around in Velcro shoes. A rather conservative practice, but to be expected in such an Earth-regarding place. Frank exchanged his shoes for some Velcro slippers by the door and followed suit. Phyllis was just finishing a talk with a couple of men. Not only a cheap and clean lift out of the gravity well, but a propulsion system for slinging loads all over the solar system. It's an extraordinarily elegant piece of engineering, don't you think? Yes, the men replied. She looked about 50 years old. After fulsome introductions, the men were from Amex, the others left. When Phyllis and Frank were the only ones left in the room, Frank said to her, "You'd better stop using this extraordinarily elegant piece of engineering to flood Mars with emigrants, or it'll blow up in your face and you'll lose your anchoring point." "Oh, Frank," she laughed. She really had aged well. Hair silver, face handsomely lined and taut, figure trim. Neat as a pin in a rust jumpsuit and lots of gold jewelry, which together with her silver hair gave her an overall metallic sheen. She even looked at Frank through gold, wire-rimmed glasses, an affectation that distanced her from the room, as if she were focusing on flat video images on the insides of her spectacles. "You can't send down so many so fast," he insisted. "There's no infrastructure for them, physically or culturally. What's developing are the worst kind of wildcat settlements. They're like refugee camps or forced labor camps, and it'll get reported like that back home. You know how they always use analogies to Terran situations, and that's bound to hurt you." She stared at a spot about 3 feet in front of him. "Most people don't see it that way," she proclaimed, as if the room were full of listeners. "This is just a step on the path to full human use of Mars. It's here for us, and we're going to use it. Earth is desperately crowded, and the mortality rate is still dropping. Science and faith will continue to create new opportunities as they always have. These first pioneers may suffer some hardships, but those won't last long. We lived worse than they do now, when we first arrived." Startled at this lie, Frank glared at her, but she didn't back down. Scornfully, he said, "You're not paying attention." But the thought frightened him, and he paused. He brought himself back under control, stared through the clear ceiling at the planet. As they were rotating with it, they always looked up at Tharsis, of course, and from this distance it looked like one of the old photographs, the orange ball with all the familiar markings of its most famous hemisphere, the great volcanoes, Noctis, the canyons, the chaos, all unblemished. "When was the last time you went down?" he asked her.
LS-60. I go down regularly," she smiled.
"Where do you stay when you descend?"
"In Unoma dorms."
Where she worked busily to break the UN treaty. But that was her job. That was what Unoma had assigned her to do. Elevator manager, and also the primary liaison with the mining concerns. When she quit the UN, she could take all the jobs she could handle from them. Queen of the elevator, which was now the bridge for the greater part of the Martian economy.
She'd have at her disposal all the capital of whatever transnational she chose to associate with. And all this showed, of course, in the way she rip-ripped around the brilliant glassine room, in the way she smiled at all his withering remarks. Well, she always had been a little stupid. Frank gritted his teeth. Apparently it was time to start using the good old USA like a sledgehammer, see if it had any heft remaining in it. Most of the transnationals have giant holdings in the States, he said. If the American government decided to freeze their assets because they were breaking the treaty, it would slow down all of them and break some.
You could never do that, Phyllis said. It would bankrupt the government.
That's like threatening a dead man with hanging. A couple more zeros on the figure are just one more level of unreality. No one can really imagine it anymore. The only ones who even think they can are exactly your transnational executives. They hold the debt, but no one else cares about their money. I could convince Washington of this in a minute, and then you just see how it blows up in your face. Whichever way it goes, it wrecks your game. He waved a hand angrily. At which point, someone else will occupy these rooms and... A sudden intuition. You'll be back in Underhill. That got her attention, no doubt about it. Her easy contempt took on a sudden edge. No single person can convince Washington of anything. It's quicksand down there. You'll have your say, and I'll have mine. And we'll see who has more influence. And she rip-ripped across the room and opened the door and loudly welcomed a gang of UN officials. So, a waste of time. He wasn't surprised. Unlike those who had advised him to come, he had had no faith in the idea of Phyllis being rational. As with many religious fundamentalists, business for her was part of the religion. The two dogmas were mutually reinforcing, part of the same system. Reason had nothing to do with it. And while she might still believe in America's power, she certainly didn't believe in Frank's ability to wield it. Fair enough. He would prove her wrong. On the trip back down the cable, he scheduled video appointments on the half hour for 15 hours a day. His messages to Washington quickly got him into complex, transmission-delayed conversations with his people in the State and Commerce Departments and with the various cabinet heads who mattered. Soon the new president would give him a meeting as well. Meanwhile, message after message, back and forth, leapfrogging around in the various arguments, replying to whichever correspondent got back to him first, it was complicated, exhausting. The case down on Earth had to be built like a house of cards, and a lot of them were bent. Near the end, with the cable visible all the way down into the Sheffield socket, he suddenly felt really odd. It was a physical wave that passed through him. The sensation passed, and after a bit of thought, he decided it must have been that the decelerating car had passed momentarily through 1G. An image came to him of running out a long pier, wet, uneven boards splashed with silver fish scales. He could even smell the salt fish stink. 1G. Funny how the body remembered it. Once resettled in Sheffield, he went back to the continuous round of recording messages and analyzing the incoming replies, dealing with old cronies and with upcoming powers. All the talk patched together into a crazy quilt of arguments proceeding at different rates. At one point, late in the northern autumn, he was engaged in about 50 conferences simultaneously. It was like those people who play chess blind with a room full of opponents. 3 weeks of this, however, and it began to come around, basically because President Incaviglia himself was extremely interested in getting any leverage he could over Amex and Mitsubishi and Arms Corps. He was more than willing to leak to the media his intent to look into allegations of treaty violations. He did that, and stocks fell sharply in the relevant quarters. And 2 days later, the Elevator Consortium announced that enthusiasm for Martian opportunities had been so great that demand had exceeded supply for the time being. They would raise prices, of course, as their creed required, but they would also have to slow down emigration temporarily until more towns and robotic town builders had been constructed. Frank first heard this on a bar TV news report, one evening in a cafe over his solitary dinner. He grinned wolfishly as he chewed. "So we see who's better at wrestling in quicksand, you bitch." He finished eating and went for a walk along the rim concourse. It was only one battle, he knew, and it was going to be a bitter, long war. But still, it was nice. Then in the northern middle winter, the occupants of the oldest American tent on the east slope rioted and threw out all the Unoma police inside and locked themselves in. The Russians next door did the same. A quick conference with Szuzinski gave Frank the background. Apparently, both groups were employed by the road-building subdivision of Arms Corps, and both tents had been invaded and attacked in the middle of the night by Asian toughs who had slashed the tent fabric and killed three men in each tent and knifed a bunch of others. The Americans and Russians both claimed the attackers were Yakuza on a race rage, although it sounded to Frank like Tsubarashi's security force, a small army that was mostly Korean. In any case, Unoma police teams had arrived on the scene and found the attackers gone and the tents in a turmoil. They had sealed the two tents, then denied permission for those inside to leave. The inhabitants had concluded they were prisoners, and enraged by this injustice, they had burst out of their locks and destroyed the piste running through their stations with welders, and several people on both sides had been killed. The Unoma police had sent in massive reinforcements, and the workers inside the two tents were more trapped than ever. Enraged and disgusted, Frank went down again to deal with it in person. He had to ignore not only the standard objections of his staff, but also the new factor's prohibition. Helmut had been called back to Earth. Once at the station, he also had to face down the Unoma police head, no easy task. Never before had he tried to rely so heavily on the charisma of the first hundred, and it made him furious. In the end, he had to simply walk through the policeman, a crazy old man striding through all civilized restraint. And no one there cared to stop him, not this time. The crowd inside the tent looked ugly indeed on the monitors, but he banged on their passage lock door and finally was let in, into a crush of angry young men and women. He walked through the inner locked door and breathed hot, stale air. So many people were shouting he could make nothing out, but the ones in front recognized him and were clearly surprised to see him there. A couple of them cheered. "All right, I'm here," he shouted. "Who speaks for you?" They had no spokesperson. He swore viciously. "What kind of fools are you? You'd better learn to operate the system, or you'll be in bags like this one forever. Bags like this, or else body bags." Several people shouted things at him, but most wanted to hear what he would say. And still, no sign of a spokesperson, so Chalmers shouted, "All right, I'll talk to all of you. Sit down so I can see who's speaking." They would not sit, but they did stand without moving, in a group around him, there on the tattered astroturf of the tent's main square. Chalmers balanced himself on an upturned box in the middle of them. It was late afternoon, and they cast shadows far down the slope to the east into the tents below. He asked what had happened, and various voices described the midnight attack, the skirmish in the station. "You were provoked," he said when they were done. "They wanted you to make some fool move, and you did. It's one of the oldest tricks in the book. They've gotten you to kill some third parties that had nothing to do with the attack on you, and now you're the murderers the police have caught. You were stupid." The crowd murmured and swore at him angrily, but some were taken aback. "Those so-called police were in on it, too," one of them said loudly. "Maybe so," Chalmers said. "But it was corporate troops that attacked you, not some random Japanese on a rampage. You should have been able to tell the difference. You should have bothered to find out."
As it is, you played into their hands and the Unoma police were happy to go along. They're on the other side right now, at least some of them. But the national armies are shifting over to your side. So you've got to learn to cooperate with them. You've got to figure out who your allies are and act accordingly. I don't know why there are so few people on this planet capable of doing that. It's like the passage from Earth scrambles the brain or something. Some laughed a startled laugh. Frank asked them about conditions in the tents. They had the same complaints as the others had, and again he could anticipate and say it for them. Then he described the result of his trip to Clark. I got a moratorium on emigration, and that means more than just time to build more towns. It means the start of a new phase between the U.S. and the U.N. They finally figured it out in Washington that the U.N. is working for the transnationals, and so they need to enforce the treaty themselves. It's in Washington's best interest, and they're the only ones that'll do it. The treaty is part of the battle now, the battle between people and the transnationals. You're in that battle, and you've been attacked, and you have to figure out who to attack back and how to connect up with your allies. They were looking grim at this, which showed sense, and Frank said, Eventually we're going to win, you know. There's more of us than them. So much for the carrot, such as it was. As for the stick, that was always easy with people as powerless as these. Look, if the national governments can't calm things down quick, if there's more unrest here and things start coming apart, they'll say the hell with it. Let the transnats solve their labor problems themselves. They'll be more efficient at it. And you know what that means for you. We're sick of this, one man shouted. Of course you are, he said. He pointed a finger. So do you have a plan to bring it to an end or not? It took a while to ratchet them into agreement. Disarm, cooperate, organize, petition the American government for help, for justice. Put themselves in his hands, in effect. Of course, it took a while. And along the way, he had to promise to address every complaint, to solve every injustice, to right every wrong. It was ridiculous, obscene, but he pursed his lips and did it. He gave them advice in media relations and arbitration technique. He told them how to organize cells and committees, to elect leaders. They were so ignorant. Young men and women, educated very carefully to be apolitical, to be technicians who thought they disliked politics, making them putty in the hands of their rulers, just like always. It was appalling how stupid they were, really, and he couldn't help lashing into them. He left to cheers. Maya was out there in the station. Exhausted, he could only stare at her in disbelief. She had been watching him over the video, she said. Frank shook his head. The fools inside hadn't even bothered to disable the interior cameras, were possibly even unaware of their existence. So the world had seen it all. And Maya had that certain look of admiration on her face, as if pacifying exploited laborers with lies and sophistry were the highest heroism. Which to her it no doubt was. In fact, she was off to employ the same techniques in the Russian tent, because there had been no progress there, and they had asked for her. The Mars First President. So the Russians were even more foolish than the Americans, apparently. She asked him to accompany her, and he was too exhausted to run a cost-benefit analysis of the act. With a twist of the mouth, he agreed. It was easier just to tag along. They took the train down to the next station, made their way through the police and inside. The Russian tent was packed like a circuit board. You're going to have a harder job of it than I did, Frank said as he looked around. Russians are used to it, she said. These tents aren't that different from Moscow apartments. Yes, yes. Russia had become a kind of immense Korea, sporting the same brutal streamlined capitalism, perfectly tailorized and with a veneer of democracy and consumer goods covering the junta. It's amazing how little you need to keep starving people strung along.
Frank, please.
Just remember that, and it will go okay.
Are you going to help or not? She demanded.
Yes, yes.
The central square smelled of bean curd and borscht and electrical fires, and the crowd was much more unruly and loud than in the American tent, everyone there a defiant leader, ready to unleash a declamation. A lot more of them were women than in the American tent. They had unpiested a train, and this had galvanized them. They were anxious for more action. Maya had to use a hand megaphone, and all the time that she stood on a chair and talked, the crowd swirled around them, and participants in several loud arguments ignored her, as if she were a cocktail lounge pianist. Frank's Russian was rusty, and he couldn't understand most of what the crowd shouted at Maya, but he followed her replies pretty well. She was explaining the emigration moratorium, the bottleneck in town robot production and in water supplies, the necessity for discipline, the promise of a better life to come if all was enacted in an orderly fashion. He supposed it was a classic babushka harangue, and it had the effect of pacifying them somewhat, as there was a strong reactionary streak in many Russians now. They remembered what social unrest really meant, and were justifiably afraid of it. And there was a lot to promise. It all seemed plausible. Big world, few people, lots of material resources, some good robot designs, computer programs, gene templates. In one really loud moment of the discussion, he said to her in English, "Remember the stick."
"What?" she snapped.
"The stick. Threaten them. Carrot and stick." She nodded. Into the megaphone again. The never-to-be-taken-for-granted fact of the poisonous air, the deadly cold. They were alive only because of the tents and the input of electricity and water. Vulnerable in ways they hadn't fully thought out, in ways that didn't exist back home. She was quick. She always had been. Back to promises. Back and forth, stick and carrot, a jerk on the leash, some niblets. Eventually, the Russians, too, were pacified. Afterward, on the train up to Sheffield, Maya gabbled with nervous relief, face flushed, eyes brilliant, hand clutching his arm as she threw her head back abruptly and laughed. That nervous intelligence, that arresting physical presence. He must have been exhausted himself, or more shaken than he had realized by the time in the tents, or maybe it was the encounter with Phyllis. Because he felt himself warming to her. It was like stepping into a sauna after a freezing day outside, with that same sense of relief from vigilance, of penetrating ease. "I don't know what I would have done without you," she was saying rapidly. "Really, you are so good in those situations, so clear and firm and sharp. They believe you because you don't try to flatter them or soften the truth."
"That's what works best," he said, looking out the window at the tents running by. "Especially when you're flattering them and lying to them."
"Oh, Frank,
it's true. You're good at it yourself." This was an example of the trope under discussion, but Maya didn't see it. There was a name for that in rhetoric, but he couldn't recall it. Metonymy? Synecdoche? But she only laughed and squeezed his shoulder, leaning against him, as if the fight in Burroughs had never happened, not to mention everything before that. And in Sheffield she ignored her stop and got off the train with him at his stop, walking at his shoulder through the spaciousness of the Rim station, and then to his rooms, where she stripped and showered and put on one of his jumpers, chattering all the while about the day and the situation at large, as if they did this all the time. Went out to dinner, soup, trout, salad, a bottle of wine, every night, sure. Leaning back in their chairs, drinking coffee and brandy. Politicians after a day of politics. The leaders. She had finally wound down and was poured into her chair, content just to watch him.
And for a wonder, it didn't make him nervous. It was as if some force field protected him from all that. Perhaps the look in her eye. Sometimes it seemed you really could tell if someone liked you. She spent the night. And after that, she divided her time between her quarters at the Mars First office and his rooms, without ever discussing what she was doing or what it meant. And when it was time for bed, she would take off her clothes and roll in next to him and then onto him, warm and calm, the touch of a whole body all at once. And if he ever started things, she was so quick to respond. He only had to touch her arm. Like stepping into a sauna. She was so easy these days, so calm, like a different person. It was amazing. Not Maya at all. But there she was, whispering, "Frank, Frank." But they never talked about any of that. It was always the situation, the day's news. And in truth, that gave them a lot to talk about. The unrest on Pavonis had gone into abeyance temporarily, but the troubles were planet-wide and getting worse. Sabotages, strikes, riots, fights, skirmishes, murder. And the news from Earth had plummeted through even the blackest of gallows humor into just plain awfulness. Mars was the picture of order in comparison, a little local eddy spun away from the vortex of a giant maelstrom, which looked to Frank like a death spiral for everything that fell into it. Little wars like matchheads were flaring everywhere. India and Pakistan had used nuclear weapons in Kashmir. Africa was dying, and the North bickered over who should help first. One day they got word that the Mohol town Hephaestus, west of Elysium, manned by Americans and Russians, had been entirely deserted. Radio contact had stopped, and when people went down from Elysium to look, they had found the town empty. All Elysium was in an uproar, and Frank and Maya decided to see if they could do something in person. They took the train down Tharsis together, back down into the thickening air and across the rocky plains now piebald with snowdrifts that never melted, with snow that was a dirty granular pink conforming tightly to the north slope of every dune and rock like colored shadows, and then onto the glistening crazed black plains of Isidus where the permafrost melted on the warmest summer days and then refroze in a bright black crackle. A tundra in the making, maybe even a marsh. Flying by the train windows were tufts of black grass, perhaps even arctic flowers, or maybe it was just litter. Burrows was quiet and uneasy, the broad grassy boulevards empty, their green as shocking as a hallucination or an afterimage of looking into the sun. While waiting for the train to Elysium, Frank went to the station's storage room and reclaimed the contents of his Burrows room, which he had left behind. The attendant returned with a single large box containing a bachelor's kitchen equipment, a lamp, some jumpers, a lectern. He didn't remember any of it. He put the lectern in his pocket and tossed the rest of it in a trash dumper. Wasted years. He couldn't remember a day of them. The treaty negotiation was now revealed as pure theater, as if someone had kicked a backstage strut and brought down the whole backdrop, revealing real history on the back steps, two men exchanging a handshake and a nod. The Russian office in Burrows wanted Maya to stay and deal with some business there, so Frank took a train on to Elysium by himself, and then joined a rover caravan out to Hephaestus. The people in his car were subdued by his presence, and irritably he ignored them and glanced through his old lectern. A standard selection for the most part, a great book series only slightly augmented by some political philosophy packages. 100,000 volumes. Lecterns today beat that 100-fold, although it was a pointless improvement, as there was no longer time to read even a single book. He had been fond of Nietzsche. In those days, apparently. About half the marked passages were from him, and glancing through them, Frank couldn't see why. It was all windy drivel, and then he read one that made him shudder. The individual is, in his future and his past, a piece of fate. One law more, one necessity more for everything that is and everything that will be. To say to him, change yourself, means to demand that everything should change, even in the past. In Hephaestus, a new Moho crew was settling in, old-timers for the most part, tech and engineering types, but much more sophisticated than the newcomers on Pavonis. Frank talked with quite a few of them, asking about those who had disappeared, and one morning at breakfast, next to a window that looked out on the Moho's solid white thermal plume, an American woman who reminded him of Ursula said, "These people have seen the videos all their life. They're students of Mars. They believe in it like a grail and organize their lives around getting here. They work for years and save and then sell everything they have to get passage because they have an idea of what it will be like. And then they get here and they're incarcerated, or at best back in the old rut, in indoor jobs, so it's all just like it's still on TV. And so they disappear. Because they're looking for more of the kind of thing they came here for. But they don't know how the disappeared live," Chalmers objected, "or even if they survive at all." The woman shook her head. "Word gets around. People come back. There are one-play videos that show up occasionally." The people around her nodded. "And we can see what's coming up from Earth after us. Best to get into the country while the chance is still there." Frank shook his head, amazed. It was the same thing the bench presser in the mining camp had been saying, but coming from this calm, middle-aged woman, it was somehow more disturbing. That night, unable to sleep, he put out a call for Arkady and got him half an hour later. Arkady was on Olympus Mons, of all places, up at the observatory. "What do you want?" Frank said. "What do you imagine will happen if everyone here slips away into the highlands?" Arkady grinned. "Why, then we will make a human life, Frank. We will work to support our needs and do science and perhaps terraform a bit more. We will sing and dance and walk around in the sun and work like maniacs for food and curiosity." "It's impossible!" Frank exclaimed. "We're part of the world. We can't escape it." "Can't we? It's only the blue evening star, the world you speak of. This red world is the only real one for us now." Frank gave up, exasperated. He had never been able to talk to Arkady. Never. With John, it had been different. But then he and John had been friends. He trained back to Elysium. The Elysium Massif rose over the horizon like an enormous saddle dropped on the desert. The steep slopes of the two volcanoes were pinkish-white now, deep in snows that had packed down to fern and would become glaciers before too long. He had always thought of the Elysium cities as a counterweight to Tharsis, older, smaller, more manageable, and sane. But now people there were disappearing by the hundreds. It was a jump-off point into the unknown nation, hidden out there in the cratered wilderness. In Elysium, they asked him to give a speech to a group of American newcomers on the first evening of their orientation. A formal speech, but there was an informal gathering before, and Frank wandered around asking questions as usual. "Of course we'll get out if we can," one man said to him boldly. Others chipped in immediately. "They told us not to come here if we wanted to get outdoors much. It's not like that on Mars," they said. "Who do they think they're fooling?" "We can see the video you sent back as well as they can." "Hell, every other article you read is about the Mars underground and how they're communists or nudists or Rosicrucians. Utopias or caravans or cave-dwelling primitives. Amazons, or llamas, or cowboys. What it is everyone's projecting their fantasies out here because it's so bad back there, do you understand? Maybe there's a single coordinated counterworld. That's another big fantasy, the totalizing fantasy. The true masters of the planet. Why not? Hidden away,
Maybe led by your friend Hiroko. Maybe in contact with your friend Akari. Maybe not. Who knows? No one knows for sure. Not on Earth, they don't. It's all stories. It's the best story going right now, and millions of people on Earth are into it. They're addicted to it. A lot of them want to come, but only a few of us get to. And a good percentage of those of us who got chosen went through the whole selection process lying through our teeth to get here.
Yes, yes, Frank interjected gloomily. We all did that. It reminded him of Michelle's old joke. Since they were all going to go crazy anyway.
Well, there you are. What did you expect?
I don't know. He shook his head unhappily. But it's all fantasy, do you understand? The need to stay hidden would hamper any community in a crippling way. It's all stories when you get right down to it.
Then where are all the disappeared going?
Frank shrugged uneasily, and they grinned. An hour later, he was still thinking about it. Everyone had moved out into an open-air amphitheater, built from fixed salt blocks in classical Greek style. The semicircle of rising white benches was filled with bodies topped by attentive faces, waiting for his speech, curious to see what one of the first 100 would say to them. He was a relic of the past, a character out of history. He had been on Mars 10 years before some of the people in the audience were born, and his memories of Earth were of their grandparents' time, on the other side of a vast and shadowy chasm of years. The classical Greeks had certainly gotten the size and proportions right for a single orator. He hardly had to raise his voice, and they all heard him. He told them some of the usual things, his standard address, all chopped and censored, as it was sadly tattered by current events. It didn't sound very coherent, even to him. Look, he said, desperately revising as he spoke, ad-libbing, searching through the faces in the crowd. When we came up here, we came to a different place, to a new world. And that necessarily makes us different beings than we were before. None of the old directives from Earth matter. Inevitably, we will make a new Martian society, just in the nature of things. It comes out of the decisions we make together by our collective action. And they are decisions that we're making in our time, in these years, right now, at this very instant. But if you dodge off into the outback and join one of the hidden colonies, you isolate yourself. You remain whatever you were when you came, never metamorphosing into a Martian human. And you also deprive the rest of us of your expertise and your input. I know this personally, believe me.
Pain lanced through him. He was astonished to feel it.
As you know, some of the first 100 were the first to disappear, presumably under the leadership of Hiroko Ai. I still don't understand why they did it. I really don't. But how we have missed her genius for systems design in the years since, I can hardly tell you. Why, I think you can accurately say that part of our problems now result from her absence these many years.
He shook his head, tried to gather his thoughts.
The first time I saw this canyon we're in, I was with her. It was one of the first explorations to this area, and I had Hiroko Ai at my side, and we looked down into this canyon, its floor bare and flat, and she said to me, "It's like the floor of a room."
He stared at the audience, trying to remember Hiroko's face.
Yes. No. Strange how one remembered faces until you tried to look at them in your mind when they turned away from you. I've missed her. I come here, and it's impossible to believe it's the same place, and so it's hard to believe I ever really knew her.
He paused, tried to focus on their faces.
Do you understand?
No, someone bellowed. A flicker of his old anger boiled through his confusion.
I'm saying we have to make a new Mars here. I'm saying we're completely new beings, that nothing is the same here. Nothing is the same.